When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue one last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue one last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Guys, welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. Guess what? It's a great question with Pat Quinn. But before we get into it, we got a lot of questions to answer. The first thing I want to do is thank our sponsors, the sponsors of this podcast. Number one is Broadback Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This is a dynamite grinder for you if you're looking for something with versatility, horizontal, vertical, different attachments, all sorts of stuff that will make your life a little easier if you're working in a shop and you're working in a small shop and you need to get some stuff going on. Broadback Ironworks for you. And if you go to broadbackironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you can get 10% off the grinders, attachments, their parts, everything you got. So definitely check out what's going on over there. And I appreciate it. It was good seeing Ryan a couple weeks ago, and I really appreciate what they're doing for this community. Number two are my friends at Evenheat. Evenheat are the manufacturer of the finest heat treat ovens available. They are unbelievable. I just had my thermal coupler go out because I'm using a lot of stainless with high temperatures, and then I'm also using the oven to kind of kiln dry wood for stabilizing. And it sent me a message saying that my thermal coupler's out, and that means that high temperatures, low temperatures, and it screws all up. I didn't send a message pulling a card saying I need something. I went to their website, ordered a new thermal coupler. It came in 2 days, and I was really psyched because now I'm back to it. So definitely check out what's going on at Evenheat. They make great, if you're hardening any materials for, you know, knives or hammers or any type of tools that need hardening, or even if you're in this glass or ceramics, definitely check out what's going on with them. And they have a new dedicated temper oven, which is really cool too. So go to evenheat-kiln.com and check out what they have. I want to thank my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. It's maritimeknifesupply.com for all your knife making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, ovens, anvils, and everything you need to get stocked or resupplied. Lawrence has got what you need. He's a knife maker. He's an awesome knife maker. And he's a great guy. He's very in tuned in regards to what is needed. So if you go to maritimeknifesupply.com and you get a 10-pack of abrasive belts, you get 10% off of that. I'm constantly surprised at how interactive he is with in regards to the podcasts, and in regards to what people are up to and what people need. So definitely check out. Well, he's a facilitator by all means. So whatever you need, he got it for you. Or if you see it and he doesn't have it, you can ask him, he'll get it. I want to thank my friends at Trojan Horse Forge. Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vise. Their vices are built in the heart of Texas, and they're designed to take your handle finishing to a whole new level. Not just that, they have plates that allow you to hand sand with comfort, with rubber and gaskets and pins, and if you to support your distal taper, to support your integral bolster, all this stuff, There's nothing more comfortable and handy for you if you're hand sanding, and then you put the handle on, you finish the handle on the vise, and it spins around 360 degrees, so you're not constantly repositioning the knife. And if you go to TrojanHorseForge.com and you put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you're going to get 10% off everything, including the T4 Sentinel Oil, the handle press attachment, everything they got. Definitely check out what they got going on. It's definitely like it will get you off using 2x4s, because we all know what 2x4s are for. They're for your firewood. So go definitely check out my friends over at Trojan Horse Forge. And all these are in the show notes wherever you're listening to this. I want to thank my friends at Baker Forge and Tool. That's BakerForge.com, Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram. I keep saying Baker Forge and Tool, but the company's called Baker Forge. BakerForge.com, and they make the great, just really great, very easy to use steels to kind of take your knife making to a different level. They have copper mine, bronze mine, tiger mine, and all these steels with a very hardenable core and layers of copper, layers of bronze, layers of wrought iron. They have stainless core. They have all this stuff. And what they do is they send you billets that are annealed. You can cut them out in your grinder. You can cut them out with your saw. And then you can make your knife, heat treat it. Stock removal's for you. You heat treat it. They have all the necessary things to hold your hand to make sure that you are successful with their product. And then afterwards, when you finish with that, you go use some of that gator piss. That's a proprietary etchant, which is pre-mixed ferric chloride and water. Water. It's proprietary. Who knows what the hell's in there? But, I mean, they call it gator piss for a reason. Stuff is awesome, and it really works great. I've been using it for a long time, and I'm really impressed by how well it works. So if you go to BakerForge.com and put in the promo code FULLBLAST, you're going to get 10% off everything. And there's a great place to go if you are trying to get some gator piss elsewhere. You can go to Texas Farrier Supply, TexasFarrierSupply.com. They have everything you need for forging, for if you're a blacksmith, you're a bladesmith, if you're a farrier, if you're involved with knife making, all that stuff. They have the Rhino Whet. They have everything you're going to need. And if you put in the promo code KnifeTalk10, you're going to get 10% off everything at Full Blast. 10% everything at TexasFarrierSupply.com, including that gator piss. So definitely check out Texas Farrier Supply, and also check out my friends at BakerForge.com. Next on my friends at TotalBoat, TotalBoat.com/FullBlast is your link to get you the two-part epoxy, to your thick set casting epoxy, to get your fathom thick set, to all the stuff you're going to need to harden that stuff up. So get yourself some of that. I've been using the two-part epoxy for the handle scales, and I'm very impressed with how well it works, how easy it is to use, how intuitive the bottling is. And they send you a ton of cups, and they send you everything you need to get yourself squared away. So if you go to totalboat.com/fullblast, that link will send you to it's an affiliate link that'll give me some street cred and give you a little bit of money off. So definitely check out what's going on. If it's good enough for Keith Deason, Derek Fromald, Keith Johnson, Keith Mitchell, and that scoundrel Jimmy DiResta, it's good enough for you. Definitely check out my friends at Total Boat. And once again, all the links and the hyperlinks are in the show notes where you're listening to this. So you don't have to call me out. You don't have to send me a message. I don't need you to send me a message asking me where it is. I need you to send me a message giving us more questions. That's for another time. Next are my friends at G.L. Hansen & Sons, makers of G-Carta. G-Carta is a unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed under epoxy and pressure. Go to gcarta.pigcartel.com to see what that's all about. Stuff is awesome. I really like the pheasant, the colorama, the hoopla, the bofa, the ripple cut, the mahi-mahi, radio worm G-Carta. You're saying to yourself, what is all this? Well, he makes this loaf. They make this loaf. Greg and Mikey make this loaf, and it looks like brain coral, and it's really beautiful, and it's got colors, and it's got movement. It looks like coral almost. And then he hardens it. I don't know how he does it, and then he cuts slices off. And then those slices become your scales, and they're really great. And if you need blocks, you can reach out to him, and he'll definitely take care of you. I had a guy who wanted an integral bolstered knife with the block of it, and I sent him a message, and he cut me up a nice block. So definitely check out what's going on with him, and I would highly suggest supporting a small business who's doing a great job with creating amazing colors, razzle-dazzle for your projects, easy to work with and finish. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my friends at Tormek. Tormek celebrating 50 years of being in business. with the Black T8 sharpening system. It's a water-cooled sharpening system that is really going to help you sharpen your tools, sharpen your axes, sharpen your chisels, sharpen your knives, and it is really great. I had a great episode with them in Sweden, and they are really focusing on the person who's creative in their house, creative in their shop, and they need to keep their tools sharp. This is for you. They have a new axe jig, a new axe sharpening jig that's like universal, really, really cool. And I'm all on board with, I had a nice message with my friend Carl, who was on the podcast from Tormek, and we were talking about the podcast, and they had a really good time. So we're definitely going to check out him. Check out Tormek. Go to Tormek_sharpening on Instagram and support my guys, because I appreciate them and I appreciate you. Wow. We're back. We're back with another episode of Great Question with Pat Quinn. Pat Quinn of the Center for Mental Arts is here to answer your questions. One of the foremost, the preeminent of experts on modern day forging in the United States, especially, and globally, I'd imagine. Pat Quinn, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little bit tired, but I'm okay. Monday, it's getting colder. I don't know if you do. Are you a Halloween guy? Do you do any Halloween stuff?
Generally no, but this year CMA has a float in the Johnstown Holiday Parade.
Oh, tell me about it.
Well, it was, you know, we decided to do it a little while ago, and, it's a really fun parade. Like, Johnstown doesn't have, any other holiday parades, so they go pretty hard on their holiday, on their Halloween parade, and, I've been going the past few years, and it's really fun because, you know, people and businesses and all that kind of stuff, they make fun floats and trailers and buses, you know, they just kind of like go hard on decorating, and then you just drive slowly through town and throw candy to the kids and stuff. And
how cool is that?
Yeah, it's pretty fun. And so this year, Heidi decided from our office that we should do it. And so we're all on board, and we're going to be doing a from the movie Aliens. And so we got all these like chest bursters and stuff like that.
That's
awesome. we're going to take the forklift and drive the forklift through the parade.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that is awesome. So how many people are going to be on the forklift?
We're going to have like 8 people, you know, and they're
Wow.
we're going to have all the aliens like on the forklift, like they're climbing around, and then, I'm going to be, Ripley with the, orange cat. So I got like a stuffed orange cat, you know, from the movie, and, that seems to be quite fitting. So
I realized that the forklift is so important to Alien. That is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have to do a lot of decorating, or?
Not really. We have some costume ideas and stuff that we're putting together, and no, it's just going to be fun. Just going to be fun. We're going to just kind of like, it's going to be the forklift's biggest journey ever, but it'll be driving it downtown from CMA and then driving it through the parade and then driving it back. It's going to be great.
That is like an album title, by the way, or song title. This is the forklift's greatest journey. That is awesome. I was wondering, I was just like, boy, I hope it's got enough juice to get all the way to Johnstown. I got to go over the bridge.
There's yeah, all sorts you got to go over the bridge all the way down Main Street and back. I think I'm going to, you know, definitely put a full propane tank on there. So
that is amazing. Well, that's yeah. Way better than my, we've gone to this Halloween party for the past like 16 years, and every year my wife and I kind of do something, and we talked to some other couple, and we decided as two couples to go as Kiss, the band Kiss.
Yeah.
So I was dressed as Gene Simmons and my wife was Paul Stanley, and then our friends were Peter Criss and Ace Frehley, and it was awesome. It was super fun. It was a little bit crazy we became vessels for Kiss.
Nice.
And the interaction was a little bit surprising. It was a little bit surprising. There was like, without going into it, I was kind of surprised at how, people thought of Kiss. So we had a good time, and, back to it. It's getting cold out, and we're all getting squared away.
Yeah.
How did the event go? You did the last time we've talked. We haven't talked since you finished the collaborative sculpture class.
Oh man, it was epic. How'd it go? Really, really good. Yeah, we it was a big success, and it was a big deal for CMA to do that, and everything worked out really well. Sculpture got finished and installed and all that good stuff. And I think everybody had a really great time participating in that. And it was a really, clear vision and first vision of, the future of that shop and its role of making modern art and contemporary forge work and all that kind of stuff. And, from my perspective, the success of it hinges a lot on, the completion of the project, which was something that I worked really hard on all year to make sure that that was going to be a reality, but also the safety and the involvement of every participant in the workshop on the big hammers. And it was incredible.
Because you had two forges going and both hammers going at the same time, right?
That's right. Two forges, two hammers, and it was the first time we've ever really done that for this. Well, ever really done it ever, and then we did it for 2 weeks, so it was like a really good test of our systems, and putting the hammers through the paces, putting the furnaces through the paces, and then actually like a really important thing that we were able to do given this opportunity was. Keep track of and record all of our consumable and fuel usage so that we can get a sense of how much it costs to run that shop, per day, per hour, per week, that kind of thing. So running it continuously for 2 weeks was really, really big moment for us. And it went fucking amazing, pardon my language. But it was awesome.
Was there anything that surprised you? I mean, I know how prepared you are in regards to this. And I know that it's also like a, I wouldn't say a risk, but I mean, there's a lot to do to have both going at the same time, especially you have two drivers and then you have all the different things and then the choreography of everything. Was there anything that surprised you in that 2 weeks?
No. I mean, I would say that I don't know, it was how successful it was, but that wasn't really surprising because of how much preparation I did. But what surprised me is that there were no unforeseen issues, I guess.
Wow. That's amazing.
I'm the kind of person that I'm very optimistic, but I always prepare for, I always mentally prepare for the worst, right? And I don't let that kind of rule my emotions or anything, but what if the air compressor goes down? What if the fan on the blower for the burners, conks out? Or what if something on the hammers, what if one of the valves gets stuck? You use all this tools and equipment sort of intermittently, and you use it under the umbrella of CMA research with CMA community and staff members. And if something happens, you pause what you're forging and you fix it, but there's nothing really at stake like there is during a workshop like this when you have, 10 people coming from very far away to participate in this experience that ultimately they, enroll in and pay money for. And then you have, the conference on top of that, and there's a lot at stake. So I just was preparing to have to fix something, or you never know. But everything went smoothly, and that was really awesome.
Because that is the crazy thing is you guys have run those hammers, but not for that length of time. And I can imagine that, something maybe that you didn't know, that the previous users would say, so go after a certain amount of weeks, you have to do this type of maintenance. And the fact that you didn't, you kind of didn't push the bounds of what you're supposed to do and not knowing the capabilities, really.
Yeah, totally. And then, it was all that stuff always has me just, and I guess that's part of running a shop like this is you can't really just come in here and just be like, oh, everything's fine, everything will be fine, you know, and ultimately it is and will be, but you always have to be prepared for everything good and bad. And so there's a lot riding on this, you know, both from like, you know, like I said, the people that invested in this experience, but also it was like a real sort of test of all our hard work for 6 years. And like, you know, there was this, you know, I established this goal for us, which was, you know, 2 furnaces, 2 hammers. And that doesn't sound like much, but the infrastructure necessary to like have that basically turnkey at this point in our development was a big deal. And it went really well. And I'm elated. I'm really excited. And, you know, I just can't wait to keep building on this and keep giving opportunity to people come here and work in the shop and experience what it's like to work on those hammers and make large scale forge sculpture or whatever, you know?
That is the most amazing thing. Just out of curiosity, like now that you have so much experience with these giant hammers, is there any, like, at the end of the day, is there any mental notes of maintenance that you have to do to get it ready for the next day?
Not really. Like, when they're running, they're great. But it's like, you know, when they shut down for several weeks and then we run them again, you know, there's things like oiling them and, you know, like now that it's getting cold too, we have to heat everything up. So I heat up these like big chunks of steel in the furnace when they're preheating and then place them on top of the ram and on the dies and next to the piston and all that and like all over the casting and stuff, because you don't want to run these like that super cold. So like, you know, and then oiling everything and stuff like that. But when you're running them continuously, like for 2 weeks, they're always kind of warm and oiled and cared for and all that kind of stuff. And that was like the biggest thing about moving here and wanting to restore that shop is like, you know, usage is the best way to preserve. And we're like, we're doing that and we're proving that theory as, you know, viable and all that kind of stuff. Because when you're running the hammers, you're monitoring the oil, you're monitoring the valves, everything is being cared for. And it's like when they sit for a long period of time, that's when things get stuck and, you know, maybe rusty or frozen or whatever. And so you have to take care when you like breathe air back into them after a long period of time. But, you know, consistent running is really good for the machines. They're made to run. You know what I mean?
Wow. That, I mean, yeah, I guess. I mean, I think that just to kind of, for the listener, these are not like 25-pound little giants. These are monstrous. I mean, can you just real quickly describe these hammers, how big they are and what they are meant for, just to keep our listeners?
Yeah, so these hammers are industrial forging hammers. They're utility hammers. They're run on external air supply, and they were installed and put into use by the Johnstown Steel Mill, Cambria Iron Company, later Bethlehem Steel, and they were used to forge large-scale forgings for industry for the steel mill and things like that. So one of the hammers that we ran, the newest one that we restored, is a 4,000-pound ram. And this hammer came to CMA in the late 1800s. Well, it came to the Cambria Iron Company in the late 1800s. And it's a 4,000-pound hammer. And just for your listeners, you know, my research, I've come to learn that, and maybe there's exceptions to this, but generally speaking, 4,000-pound ram is the biggest ram that you can run with a single arch frame hammer. So anything over 4,000 pounds has to be a double arch hammer, which is kind of like, you know, a horseshoe shape or something like that. So this is a big hammer. It's the biggest single frame hammer that's available to run. And it's really old, But, you know, stuff like this, it's incredibly simple and with the right care should last for generations and generations. And we're putting that care back into it or whatever. But yeah, these are, you know, these are big hammers. They're not toys, and they demand a lot of respect, and they're just wonderful to be used in a creative way at this point, I feel like.
It's there. I mean, every time I see them, it's just more and more astounding. Take me back to the sculpture. I love the imagery of you guys installing the sculpture outside of CMA.
Yeah.
That is so great that you're able to make these kind of outdoor sculpture park.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think like this was a big step because this last year with Pete Matilla was the first year that we used the hammers at all as part of the 2-week collaborative sculpture that students participated in. And what that was like was a general collaborative sculpture class at CMA, which takes place in the classroom under the, you know, 200 pound hammers and all that the classroom has to offer. And then during the conference demonstration with the team of blacksmiths that's comfortable and safe and familiar with the big hammers, we forged some elements that then got added as parts of this collaborative sculpture, which is that big piece in the back of our yard back there that a lot of people are familiar with. And so this year, wanted to take it one step further and make the entire collaborative sculpture class take place in the octagon under the big hammers. And rather than have the people that I know are experienced enough and safe enough to run these hammers, I wanted to give that opportunity to students and other people in the forging community. So I designed something that I felt like was achievable in this room without power. So basically all we had to rely on was two hammers and two furnaces. And I think we had an oxy fuel torch in there for some cutting that we needed to do. And so all of the forging and all of the riveting was done under these hammers. And then we were able to assemble everything in the octagon. We had to fabricate it to a base before installation, but we installed it, you know, on Thursday. So we actually came in a little ahead of schedule, which is exactly how I like to work. I didn't want to have to like push the envelope or work late or compromise safety or any of that stuff. So it was a really great experience.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is when you look at the collaborative sculptures that you've done, you see this. I mean, just looking at the first one you did was with Jake James, and then the second one was that giant riveted sculpture of I-beams outside by the river. Who I forgot his name. The guy Steve Howell.
Yeah.
And then the amazing thing is there's a, and I feel as though there needs to be some sort at some point, and I'm sure you have this. You have like a history of there's an evolution on all the sculptures, and the evolution is where they're built, where in CMA they've been built, and now you have this real evolution in terms of now it's all done in the octagon. You can kind of see where all the sculptures have been growing from.
Yeah, definitely, and it's a nice progression.
Yeah,
and you know, in a way, it's like a sculptural history of the development of CMA, which I think is really fun to like be here and see it all and think of it chronologically and stuff like that.
Definitely milestones. I see, you know, for me, it's almost like I was, this isn't the greatest analogy, but like somebody was talking to me about my tattoos and I was just saying, well, you know, you have to see everyone as like a milestone of the person that you are to a certain degree. And there are certain things in as artists that we see as milestones in a specific time based on what you can do at the moment. And the great thing is that's really, to me, one of my favorite things about seeing sculpture or seeing art in general is to kind of look at, and I've said this a million times, but I've been fortunate enough to kind of watch you grow as an artist. And I've been able to see how each sculpture is a milestone in regards to not only your technique, but your capabilities and what you're able to do at that moment. And obviously, yeah, you know, you when you look back on older sculpture, you have to be, or older art, you have to kind of separate yourself out from what your capabilities are in the present time, and you have to kind of appreciate where that's from. So
I'm
a huge fan of that. I mean, that's like, for me, that's what art's about, is it's not just a nice sculpture, but it's like where it came from and where is it going. And then you'd be able to have some type of real conversation in regards to the growth of the of what's been made at CMA.
Right.
And you're happy with the sculpture, you're happy with where it came where it is. Are you thinking about the next one, or?
Oh yeah, man. I'm happy with the sculpture. I'm happy with where it is. I'm happy with everything about it, from, you know, the parts that happened exactly as planned to the parts that had to, like, you know, just let the difference in scale dictate the final piece, and which was a bit of a departure from the maquette. And I see it all as really great learning experiences. And, you know, when I look at it, I'm overwhelmed with gratitude and appreciation for everybody that's helped get CMA to this step, everybody that's participated in the workshop and all that kind of stuff. And ever since this thing ended, I have been working like tirelessly on the next one already. And, you know, how do you, like, take this amazing opportunity that you basically, like, you know, were thrown into, because as most of you know, Christoph was going to do this the first time. And so I was kind of like, you know, put into this situation, and it, the whole thing was like, well, let's like prove the concept. Let's see if this works, blah, blah, blah. And it did. And, so it's been a lot of writing, a lot of recording, you know, and then just like, how do you take something that was kind of like amorphous and, like, you know, off the cuff and going on like feel and gut instinct, and how do you create a structure for it that we can move on to, like, continue year after year and make sure that it's, you know, available to the broadest possible audience, and that it's safe, and that everybody who wants to participate can participate. But how do you make sure that, like, people are ready to participate or ready to teach even? So it's like, I got this, you know, I've been doing a lot of writing, which is really helpful for me, and it's really helpful to get like a structure down for it, you know. And it's like, well, it made me realize, it's like, wow, you know, I know now what it takes to teach this and what it takes for it to be successful. And so, you know, I've written that all down, right? And so if somebody says, hey, I really want to teach that workshop someday, I go, oh, that's great. You know, have a look at this, because this is what it takes to make it successful. Are you up for the challenge? You know what I mean? Stuff like that. So it's not just like, yeah, come on over, we'll kind of like figure it out. It's like, no, you have to have a quarter scale maquette at CMA by April so that I can, like, get the material, make the tools, all that kind of stuff to create a successful workshop in September. You know what I mean?
Wow. That's amazing. That's one of the most amazing parts. Every time I come down to see you, how organized everything is, how thoughtful, how intentioned, and how serious you are in regards to the success. It's not, nothing's fly by night. And I was thinking when you were talking about this, it must be incredibly exciting. You finished that sculpture. The class went great. It went faster than you expect. No, you came in under the deadline, which in terms of, and that's amazing. And I feel as though maybe it's just like you get so excited that you're ready for the next one, but you're very smart to just kind of slow back down to the way you do things, and to make sure that all your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed, and that's how you get the success. But sometimes I wonder, I don't know how you don't just get so overwhelmed with excitement and you just kind of jump back in.
Dude, well, there is that, right? Like, and that's part of learning too. And so it's like, and I've preached this before a lot, but like, you know, sometimes you just want to light a fire and put a chunk of steel in the furnace and see what happens. And that's a really valuable learning experience. And that teaches you a lot about, honestly. And we do that sometimes in the octagon, right? Because you need that experience. But preparation is the most important thing for success. And it's like, somehow, you know, I just feel like that often gets overlooked. And although I said, like, well, this is kind of like a let's see how it goes kind of a situation, and there was aspects about that that were that because we've never done it before. But, you know, I was preparing for this workshop since, you know, April or May, and it was all of that preparation. I'm not trying to friggin' toot my own horn here, but, like, I look back at the experience and I really feel like all that preparation was necessary for the success that everybody sort of was able to witness and be a part of and share in together. And I think, like, the maquette and the math, and forgive me if your listeners are sick of hearing about math, and Mark, you know, my partner here in the shop, was like monumental in the success of this workshop because he tackled all the math for me from the maquette to the full scale sculpture. And that was 100% necessary to even know if we had enough material on hand to make the sculpture. And it's like, you can't do anything on this scale without preparation unless you're like way into like wasting time and money.
Right. Well, I mean, there is this concept, I think, that a lot of people, especially getting into forging, I find that there's a lot of shoot first, ask questions later. And sometimes I think that works, but in regards to trying to be successful with executing your creativity and with the expectations that you have, you can't shoot first and ask questions later. You got to ask the questions first and then be prepared for when it's time to hit the steel.
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing is fine if it's just for fun,
right?
Right, or if it's a hobby or it's something you do for recreation or whatever, like, totally. But if I mean, and I'm not like, I worry that people think I'm like too serious or whatever, because it is really fun here, but like it is very serious as well, and I take everything really seriously, even the fun.
Yeah,
but you got to prepare, you know, and there's too much at stake. There's too much on the line, both from people's participation to the monetary investment that CMA has to make to even run that shop, to not be prepared. I owe it to the community and to the students to prepare as much as possible. And I think that's like sort of the point of this whole thing, is like, you know, the thought of having other people teach in that workshop, it's like, I want that to be the ultimate goal for sure, but there has to be, whoever wants to teach in there has to be like able and willing to have put in a lot of work ahead of time to make it successful.
With that said, it's very exciting. We could keep on going with this for a long time, but in terms of the whole idea of collaboration, I love everything about what you do with collaboration. This episode, Great Question with Pat Quinn, is also about collaboration. So if you're listening to this now, dear listener, if you're interested in this podcast and you want to contribute to this podcast, you go to a Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, or you go to the Center for Metal Arts on Instagram, or you go to Hand Forged and VT on Instagram. I'm going to link all those. I'm going to link all those usernames in the show notes. You can submit questions for Pat to answer, and this is our opportunity to listen to what the questions that the listeners have, and then hopefully we can shed some light on it. Does that sound good? You ready, Pat?
Yeah, I love the way that sounds. Okay. I think that's a good situation.
Okay, so this is some questions from the listeners that we've put together, and obviously you can submit anytime you want. I told you where to go. This one, first one, comes from Nate Weiss. We all know Nate. Nate asks, what's a good way to advocate for yourself as a craftsperson in a business way?
That's a great question. And, you know, we sort of like talk about this a lot, you know, personally, you and I, Jeff, because it has a lot to do, I think, with like social media and stuff like that. But, I think it all really depends on the outlet, that you want to have for your craft. I mean, you know, the questions I ask somebody that might ask that question is, you know, what is your desired way to be a professional in this craft? Because I think, you know, it's all about professionalism and stuff like that. And so it's like, do you want to be a teacher? Do you want to be a tool maker? Do you want to do commission work? Do you want to do, you know, historical recreation kind of stuff? And so, you know, if you ask yourself those kinds of questions, then you can help, you know, figure out best way to sort of market yourself or present yourself to the public and things like that. So I think, like, really, to me, it's all about public presentation. And, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I remember when I was in Carbondale and, got an Instagram account or whatever, and I was posting a bunch of stuff, like joking around, cats, you know, pizza, like whatever it was. And then I started selling hammers. And that sort of like made me pause for a second, and I went like, oh, well, I can use this platform as a way to market my work and advertise for myself. And I wanted to be taken seriously as a tool maker. And so, you know, I stopped posting photos, so many photos of my cats and the pizza I was eating and the parties I was at, and posted more professional work and things like that. And I noticed that, you know, the orders came in, and it just, you know, was a really good way to kind of like get your name out there. I know things are different nowadays, and it's not as pure as it used to be, but I think it's just, you know, it's how do you present yourself, and what sort of community are you presenting yourself to, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. I think there's a lot to it, because the crazy part is if you, when you think about, I still believe that craftspeople and artists are in the same, they're in the same situation. And the hardest part is a lot of times some of them, especially when you become an artist, it's hard to advocate for yourself as being in business, because there's history and history and history of artists not being, they're focusing on their executing their creativity less in regards to how they can kind of move forward as a, you know, as a business to propel your family or whatever, pay your bills or whatever. So we're now at this point where there are these tools at our disposal to help us, stop us from having to use brokers or agents or people to, you know, like I usually refer to the, well, we don't have to talk about it, but I usually refer to the gallery system as a pimp situation. And I think that you have a lot of abilities to advocate for yourself. The problem is we're still learning as, pardon me, as artists and craftspeople how to be in business. So we're not having a general focus in regards to what we want to accomplish. And this is back to what you were talking about, a preparation. I think that the most, in my opinion, is to have a really clear goal in regards to what you're doing, figuring out what you need to do it, and then you address your strengths, and then you also address your weaknesses and try to figure out how can I fix my weaknesses in order to make my business go forward. That's mm-hmm. my opinion. It's a tricky spot, because what happens is people learn how to do something that is craveable, like maybe you're a tool maker, maybe you're a knife maker. And all of a sudden, people want to give you money, and then you want to keep the ball rolling. But how do you grow in a way that's sustainable? And that's the hardest part.
Yeah, and I hate to, like, you know, because I think everybody who knows me knows I'm not money driven. But everybody has to be considerate of it to a certain degree. And I think part of like being an independent artist or craftsperson or whatever is you've got to like decide what kind of lifestyle that you want to live, because you can have, a high expense lifestyle or a low expense lifestyle, but you've got to, at the end of the day, you've got to be generating the revenue it takes to sustain the lifestyle that you want. And, for me, my lifestyle is a shop like CMA's that, has a lot of good forging equipment and tools and machining stuff and all that sort of stuff. So I have to I work really hard to generate enough revenue to sustain what I do here. And it's not like generate enough revenue to stack my bank account so I can have 10 beach houses. It's like generate enough revenue to keep my staff and keep payroll going, keep everybody insured, the health insurance, and the gas flowing and the steel coming in. And that's really it. But I consider all that, right? And so it's could I need to take in less if it was just a small studio that I had with a coal forge, and an anvil? Sure. But you have to just you have to consider what you want out of life and sort of structure yourself in a way that what you do generates the income to sustain that. And unfortunately, with a lot of us, it the stuff we make isn't really needed by people, so it's hard to justify buying it, right? And so there's a really great supportive community around what we do that, buy hammers and tongs from me, and buy dividers from Nate and the hammers he makes and all that kind of stuff, because his work is really great. But that's a really small sort of is a really small market, and can that sustain your lifestyle? And in his case, perhaps it can. But I think in general, as this question relates to a broader audience, you've got to really consider that. And it's if you want to own a house, have a family, or some of these things that, need more financial resources to sustain, then you've got to make certain decisions about what you're making, who you're marketing to, and I guess, how you make it, right? Because you might want to,
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
Employ CNC technology or a burning table or something like that that can help streamline your product so you can make it more available to people maybe of lower income or whatever, so that you sell more. All this sort of stuff has got to be considered.
It's the toughest part that we don't talk about is the fact that society's changed. Society's changed and our buying habits have changed.
Totally.
Without getting into it too far, I in my town we're having problems with people are not buying as much, they're not going to stores as much, and they're talking about, they're not really addressing the fact that people's buying habits are changing, and they're buying things on Amazon or they're buying things online, and they're not, the brick and mortar store is dying. And what I'm getting at is we need to kind of see what's happening in the world, see what's happening with social media, and see what's happening, and figure out ways in which to be flexible to keep our dream alive. That's the hardest part, is to kind of not say, I used to be like this and I don't know what happened, but you have to be okay, now things are different and we need to figure out ways to be more flexible, because business is hard.
Well, it is. It's super hard. And I think it's not getting any easier, to be quite honest. And I think for people like us, this isn't even specific to Nate or whatever, but it's just hard. It's hard to make what you want to make and make a living, right? Lots of times. And that works. I've never sold a sculpture, right? And I don't friggin' care to sell a sculpture because that's not my business. But I've created a professional life for myself where I can generate revenue to sustain CMA, and then I can make sculpture. And, you know, I always sometimes get kind of like jealous of a guy like Jesse Savage, who has a full-time job and you know, forges more for fun than for to sustain his lifestyle. And then if you're set up like that, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but you know, the enjoyment and joy of the craft, it doesn't get tainted by you know, needing to sustain your family or your lifestyle, and you can have fun forging, and then you have this other thing that you do that, you know, generates revenue to sustain your lifestyle. And sometimes you've got to pick that, right? And so, like, when I was in Vermont and trying to be like a self-employed blacksmith and chasing like commission work jobs and trying to make furniture and handrails and stuff like that and make the sculpture I wanted to make, I did landscaping, like, you know, 3 days a week. I was mowing lawns, I was weed whacking, I was, you know, tending garden beds and stuff like that, because I didn't have a family or own a house or anything like that, but you need to pay your utilities and you need to put food on the table, for no matter, you know, if it's just you or whatever. But, you know, I had to have something else to help supplement my desire to make what I wanted to make, you know?
Yeah. No, listen, forging, Jesse, bringing up Jesse is perfect, because, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I get to see him, you know, every so often. And I do see him as more like a, like someone who's kind of in tune with the passion that he has. And he's not burdened by having to make tough decisions in regards to how the shop is run. And that is very enviable. Is very enviable as a craftsperson. He knows how much time he has in the shop, and he's very efficient with that time. And there is something very enviable about the fact that, like you said, he's not tainted by the trappings of having to, you know, use what he does to make money.
Yeah, and I mean, think about researching a new style of joinery or something from the, you know, 1800s or whatever strikes your fancy that looks like something you want to try, but needing to make a living from being a blacksmith. It gets really hard, because you can research that and you can fail, but then the failure often, you know, results in like lost revenue or lost income. But if you're just forging for fun and you do this other thing, then you can fail all you want and have joy in the learning that you're doing, rather than like fear of the bill paying or whatever.
There you go. I think we can't get much better than that. The next question comes from our friend Steven. That's Hey Budden. Hey Budden is unbelievably great, great, great guy. It was good to see him a couple weekends ago. I love the collaborative workshop program, programs. Working and learning with others to bring an artist's vision to life is the best, and I can't wait to continue to do more at CMA. While I enjoy working from a plan, I really want to be able to create the plan, the artist spark, if you will. It might be something that not everyone can learn. What advice do you offer for late bloomers trying to move from craftsman to artist? Great question.
It's a great question. It reminds me a lot of the question Tim Lucas had a few episodes ago.
Yes.
Like, you know, about inspiration and what's like, you know, what's the difference between a craftsperson and an artist, and how do you thread that needle, toe that line, like all that kind of stuff. And it's a difficult one to answer, as they all are, but it's like, I just, that whole idea of, you know, this artist spark that, you know, maybe it's not teachable, and it's, you know, I don't know if it is or isn't teachable. It's like I get inspired to make sculpture every second of every day based on everything that I see. And And I don't know that you can teach that. And I'm not saying you have to be like that to be an artist or whatever. But, you know, my advice for this question is to, like, keep a journal, and a journal that you can also sketch in. And then, you know, I get inspired by things that I see in the most random places, right? Like, it maybe it's the negative space between two telephone poles, or, you know, the flight pattern of a bird through the air or whatever. And that makes me think of a sculpture or a forging that I want to make, or a technique that I want to try. And then I have to write that down, right? And if I can, then I'll also make a little back of the napkin sort of sketch of it. And the more that I can sort of record the inspiration, the more, like, backlog of work that I have to create or want to create, right? And then that equates to, like, when you get to the shop and you're just like, gee, I wonder what, you know, you want to work, but you're not sure what to make, which I think is a struggle that a lot of people might have who struggle with, like, creative inspiration or something like that. Then you, all of a sudden you have this, like, backlog of it. And that's not to say that you have to make exactly that one thing that you drew, but maybe you turn around and a couple months go by and you start to combine a bunch of your drawings and make a composition, or it's just an inspiration to try a different shape and make a new tool, right? And then it's like a snowball effect, because you start and then you grow from what you make, and then one forging might inspire another, and then you just continue to keep working. But I think You gotta record your inspirations, I think.
For me, I feel like years and years ago, I used to have interns, and I'm a huge fan of the intern project, because I was an intern in art school. I really worked for a lot of artists, and I learned, and I talked to a lot of parents, and parents would say to me, "My son wants to be an artist. What do you suggest?" And I said, you've got to be compelled. And when you have to be compelled, you have to be so compelled that if you were on a deserted island with no one hope of rescue, you'd still want to make sculpture. I said, that's the mindset. And it makes me think in regards to a lot of people who want to be artists, or they want to try to make sculpture. I think that there's this misconception that everything has to be shown or seen. And the best part about being an artist is learning on your own without necessarily having people watch every step you do. So every sculpture doesn't have to, or every piece of art doesn't have to be for the public. Every piece of art or piece of sculpture can be just another step towards your evolution in regards to what you're trying to do. We were talking earlier in regards to milestones as sculptors and milestones as artists, and every one of the sculptures at CMA, you can kind of CSI where it was made and who made it and what the capabilities were. To me, Stephen, the most important thing is just move your ass and make something. It doesn't have to be shown. You know, it doesn't have to be something that is meant to be the masterpiece. Everyone says masterpiece. Don't worry about masterpiece. You have to understand that whatever you do today, the next one will be better. And that's the one thing I tell young craftspeople, young artists. When you're making sculpture, you can't covet your work, because you have to, in your mind, and it might not work every time, but in your mind, you have to know that the next one's going to be better. And then I like to be a little frivolous with my work in terms of just, like, you know, not just like burn, you know, like make it and throw it in the garbage. But at the same time, I have to have the mindset, this is a stepping stone based on today, but tomorrow's going to be different. So my suggestion would be is just move your ass and make something. And then, you know, use that as a stepping stone for the next thing you make, and not worrying about a master. Everything doesn't have to be a masterpiece. Everything can be a stepping stone. And that's where you will find the joy in regards to what you're doing.
Yeah. You know, that term masterpiece is like, what even is that?
It's idiotic.
It doesn't even exist. And nobody makes a masterpiece trying to make a masterpiece. And I don't think there is such a thing anymore. But I think what we're talking about, you know, your get up and move kind of thing is, you know, it reminds me of a quote that I read in Matt's book, that the hook book was, you know, never trust a blacksmith with an empty scrap bin. And there's a lot of truth to that. And that's why I always say, like, I love scrapping stuff, because scrapping stuff means forward progress.
Right.
And so, yeah, get out there, make some stuff, record your inspirations, and don't put too much pressure on yourself.
That's the most important thing. Is I back in the day, my father was an incredible painter. I loved his paintings, and he never put it in galleries. And a lot of it was because he was afraid, or sell the work. And a lot of it was because he was afraid he couldn't do it again. And I felt as if that was like very stunting in regards to his development as an artist. And I feel as though with Steven, I really like, you're super talented. You're incredibly generous. You're a great guy. Just make some shit, and then, you know, then make some more tomorrow, and then make some more tomorrow. And then don't, I think the artists sometimes get a little bit too prescriptive on how they're supposed to be seen. Some of this stuff doesn't need to be seen, and some of this stuff just needs to be an exercise.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, how great is Hooked? Is Hook?
Oh, it's the best. I mean, it is the most inspiring project I think I've ever seen. And it, you know, I just texting with Matt yesterday or something, just telling him how much I'm enjoying, you know, reading the book and looking at the pictures and stuff. And it's just like, and then the foreword by Peter Ross has this really like impactful quote, which was that, like, I'm not going to get it verbatim, but, you know, he says, like, well, Matt embarked on one of the most difficult things ever, which is to be creative on a deadline. And that, I think, is like such a really important way to push yourself and grow as somebody, because, you know, creativity can be like a muscle, and you need to exercise it, and you need to like accept the failures and, you know, fill the scrap bin, and then also like take the picture of something that you like. And it's a lifelong pursuit, and it doesn't come, like, you know, inherently to everybody. And even somebody like me, sometimes you have to work at it. And this was like a really great exercise. And it's like, you know, and I'm not a copycat, and I can't stand copycats, but like, I want to do this project just for fun. Like, I don't even have to post about it, but it's like, I want to put myself through that same creative exercise, you know?
I had him on a month or so ago, and we talked about the book, and I love the book. And he was very honest. He was very honest in regards to, there were days where I didn't want to do it. There were days where I had to double up because I went to an event. So if you buy the book Hook, and I'll have it in the show notes where you can get it from Matt Jenkins, and we actually have a Matt Jenkins question coming up. It was making a hook, a different hook, every day for a year. And it was incredible. And it's a huge undertaking. And there were days where he didn't feel well. There were days he had to go on a visit. Days he had to go visit a family, or he couldn't be in the shop. You know, you think about all the things you have to do 365 days a year. And there were days where he had to double up, or he had to do two because he knew that he was going to be around for the. And there were times where he didn't like the hook. You know, and that's just the way it is. And I think
the way it is.
It's just the way it is. And you just got to move forward. And the fact is like, it is an incredible book. And Matt was just so, he was very, like, it was very funny because he was just very understated in regards to the job, you know? And he's great. He's great. And I would use, if you're looking to how to execute creativity, the book Hook by Matt Jenkins is definitely one of those books that'll inspire you to do, you know, maybe you just decide, all right, I'm going to do every once a week, I'm going to do this, or once a two, you know, every day I'm going to do this. It's great. My old, my first drawing teacher in college used to say, you have to draw every day. That's it. You have to draw every day, and that's the end of it. And, you know, there are, you know, ways in which you can kind of have to, you know, executing creativity on a deadline is tough. It is really tough.
Totally, great. Man.
All right. Let's keep going. This one comes from What's Cooking in the Shop podcast. I think that's my guy, J-Mod Knives. You got a 1924 50-pound Little Giant. Do you run it because it runs, or do you restore it properly?
run it, I guess. But I mean, there's a difference between it runs and it you know, performs the function you want it to. So if you're able to forge what you want, don't restore it just because it'll look prettier. I think there's like a, you know, this thing happening now where like all your machines have to look like they're restored. And I don't really subscribe to that. Like, you restore things to make them function properly. And, you know, I do restore stuff and make it look good as well. But I think that might be more like if you want to sell it on the secondary market or something, it has a bit more attraction if it looks really good. But I say if the hammer runs to your liking and, you know, it's not like wearing in a way that's damaging something or whatever, then I say you run it and then you just sort of like you restore or fix what's necessary when it's necessary. Don't restore something that doesn't need restoration, basically, is what I'm saying.
It's great. I mean, I have nothing to add. I'm a little frivolous, I think, with some of these things. And
what's that mean?
I mean, I was never, I just, part of me is like, some people eat to live and some people live to eat. And I find myself being in a situation where sometimes I just don't have it in me to restore things. And maybe that's just part of who I am. Maybe it's just because I don't care enough. It's a demerit. It's a demerit on the person that I am, most likely. But
well, no, I mean, dude, it's like, are you in the restoration business or are you in the forging business?
Right.
And it's like, if you're in the forging business, then forge. And if you're in the restoration business, then restore. And it's like, and then the tricky part is if you do both, but like, you know, it doesn't really feel like, I mean, I guess I do both, but like, I restore the equipment and then I use it. I don't, you know, restore it for any other reason. And I don't restore what doesn't need to be restored. And it, for me, it's like, it has a little bit to do with like historic authenticity or whatever. And it's like, I will clean things for sure, but I haven't been cleaned or touched since 1992. So I feel like I owe them that. And then that's it. And then I restore it to functionality. And then, you know, from there I just use it, right? So if it ran when I got here, I wouldn't overly restore it just for the sake of saying I restored it or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I like, what I do like is I have friends who restore, they get little giant hammers, and then maybe, I had a friend of mine who got one. It was in boxes, and he took it all apart. He stripped every piece, and he did get a better sense of how things are supposed to fit and things are supposed to run. And mm-hmm. I feel like he had a better understanding of the tool in general. And I mm-hmm. think that that's a really big highlight in regards to what you can get out of restoring a piece, especially something you're going to use by yourself. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's like, I got to run a business. I can't stop the shop for us to, you know, restore tools that we don't, just for the sake of it.
I mean, and that's like, I agree with you 100%. And I agree with the fact that restoration does lead to education about the piece of equipment. And that's really important. And if that's something that you value or you think like, well, you know, it's going to benefit me personally or emotionally or monetarily later down the line with my business to understand every nook and cranny of this machine, then that's an investment in yourself and that's an investment in your business, and go for it. You know what I mean? So, there's a lot to consider. And then, you know, it even goes back to Nate's question. It's like, you know, do you have time? Like, are you dependent on this hammer to make money, or is it just a fun thing that you play with on the weekends? And if it's like a fun thing that you play with, that's great. Like, I'm not knocking that in any sense. And maybe if that's the case, then you do take it apart and you have fun looking at all the parts and pieces and you spend time making, you know, all that sort of stuff. But like, that's a new concept, right? And that's like why that's the difference between us and them. And when I say them, I mean any blacksmith before, you know, the 1990s, or, and that's even, you know, giving it credit, because, you know, that's why, you know, my Nazel, the top die was welded to the ram, right? Because it didn't, it wasn't a passion project. The people who had that hammer needed to run a business. And when the die kept coming loose, they were faced with two options. They were like, take it out, make a new die, remachine the dovetails, make a new key, put it back together. And then somebody went, no way, that's going to take way too long. Just weld that thing in there and get back to work. And so it's like, times are different, of course. And I would never weld a die to a ram, but sometimes you do have to just get back to work. And so, you know, it really depends on your usage of the machine. You know what I mean?
Perfect. Perfect. Totally perfect. Speaking of Matt Jenkins, Cloverdale Forge, author of Hook, he's got a question. Here's one for great question. If you use different sized hand hammers for different scale of work at the anvil, is it wise to choose a power hammer to fit your scale of work, or is, quote, bigger always better? Asking for a friend. He does have a follow-up, which is what list of parameters do you consider when sizing the hammer to your work?
Bigger is not always better, for sure. And I always say, when it comes to power hammer work, that power is nothing without control. So, almost every power hammer can hit hard. It's the ones that hit light that are the most valuable, that hit light as well, are the most valuable. Especially if you have any sort of degree of finesse work in your product or your forging, or if you're like me and you like the surface quality of a forging and you don't always need to clobber it, then you need to work with a hammer that has a range of power and controllability. And to me, those are the most valuable hammers. And I think size really does matter, in a sense that, like, you have to be considerate of the size material that you're forging when selecting your hammer. And then, so I know with like Little Giants, or like even my Bradley and most mechanical hammers, you have this ability to sort of adjust the height of the ram before you run the machine to most efficiently forge the size material you want to forge with that hammer. And to me, that's the benefit of an air hammer, is you don't have to make those adjustments. You can forge, you know, 4-inch tall flat bar just as efficiently as you can forge like 1/2-inch square bar or something. But I always consider the size of the hammer and the size of the work that I'm making. And so I think anything like 200 pounds and under is really great. I think a 110 air hammer is kind of like a really good all-purpose hammer. And I think, you know, the 200 or 175 pounders we have in the classroom are great, because you can get a little bit more material thickness forgeability with a 200 pound hammer than you can like a 110, but you still get all of the finesse work to forge something down to like 1/4-inch. But then anything sort of like above that, you have to like visualize in your head this like graph, you know. And so the bigger the hammer is, the less ability you have to forge smaller stock. And so, you know, if you were to just have a big hammer, you're probably going to struggle a little bit with some of the more finesse work that you might need to do. And so you have to look within yourself and decide what's best for the kind of work that you like to create. And I think somewhere between 100 and 200 pounds is a really good sort of like all-purpose hammer. But once you get any bigger than that, you're going to like leave a lot to be desired on the low end. And that's a sacrifice you have to make for having the ability to forge something bigger, you know what I mean?
And back to his original question, how do you differ if you use different size hand hammers for different scale of work in the anvil? Well, I guess you answered the question, but what I was interested in is how do you decide what hand hammer you're using based on the scale?
I don't know anything about hand hammers, but I do know, like when, for instance, I have a Nazel 2B, which has 165-pound RAM, and there's something wrong with it where it doesn't short stroke, right? So I have a really hard time forging smaller material or planishing or doing like any kind of finesse work, but it hits really hard. So I have a no problem forging bigger iron with it. And so, you know, right next to it, I have my 110 Ritter hammer. And so that allows me to like take a big chunk and forge it on the nazel. And then when it gets below a certain cross section that the nazel is too big for, I jump right over to the Ritter and I can finish the forging that way.
Wow.
And then there is a question here about die radiuses or whatever, but they match on all my hammers so that I can use all different hammers without, you know, a different die radius profile giving me undesirable hammer marks inside of a transition.
Well, let's just do that question. That was from Acorn Forge. He asked, what kind of radius do you like on your dies and anvils, et cetera?
Yeah, I love this question because it's something that I take like very seriously. And I have the same radius on all of my tools. And I think the bigger your forgings are, the bigger of a radius you need. And the smaller your forgings are, naturally, the smaller of a radius you need. But the most important thing really is that it's consistent amongst all your tooling.
Huh. So everything is the same sized radius on the faces of the dies.
Yes, sir.
Wow. I used to make the point to kind of, and maybe you tell me if I'm wrong, but I used to make the point with a lot of blacksmiths that when you're using a hammer, you have to see it like a pebble in the water. When you throw a pebble in the water, the first part of the crown of the radius of your hammer is the part that the water hits first, and then the water kind of spreads around it, and then it makes the ripple based off of the size of the rock. And I feel like that there's a very close connection between how steel is hit with a hammer as a rock falls into the water.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about the depth of penetration, right? So if you have a quarter-inch piece of flat bar, and you have a rounding hammer, and your rounding hammer radius is like, you know, really, really big, and you swing that rounding hammer into that quarter inch piece of flat bar, how deep of a hammer mark did you make? And that's all the radius you need. So anything beyond that radius isn't doing anything for the work, honestly. And the smaller the radius, the more aggressively it moves it. But I've seen these rounding hammers that are like very, very round. And then honestly, it almost is like a ball peen because it's so round that you're not really using anything other than a little like half inch section of the point, you know, the tip of that radius in the middle of your rounding hammer. And so you have to think about that when you're profiling your hammers for sure.
Yeah, because now that really makes a lot of point, because the wider, the bigger the face of your hammer, there's not a lot of connection between the face of the hammer based off of how hard you swing it.
Right.
Oh, man. That never even dawned on me. I thought the rest of it was just like, you know, part of it was the force of the swing.
Well, it is to a certain, you know, it's force plus, you know, surface area, right? Or minus surface area or whatever. To me, you know, all of forging comes down to how much surface area are you displacing in each hammer blow. And the smaller amount of surface area, the less hard you have to hit it in order to get the depth of penetration you need to do your forging. And that's why you use fullers, and that's why you use the edge of your anvil or the horn or, you know, a smaller die on a power hammer or something like that. It's like if you take a 200-pound hammer and you put these big honking dies on there, you're just, it's going to feel like you're just slapping the surface because you're trying to displace like so much surface at once. If you take the same hammer and you put like 1-inch radius fuller dies on there, you're going to send those so deep into the material because you're minimizing the surface area that you're displacing, and you're going to forge a lot more efficiently.
Mind blown. You put that in a
simple
way.
Simple, dude. Simple principles of forging.
God damn it, Pat Quinn. That was a great answer. Jesus.
What do you think you learn when you come to CMA take power hammer class? All that stuff.
Guys, you listen, get on board. You learn the principles that'll change your life. It's not on YouTube, ladies and germs. Let's hit another one. This one comes from Benjamin Blacksmithing. Benjamin Blacksmithing says, I saw a bunch of hammers at CMA have blue painted handles and was curious what's that for. Also, since you mentioned that you switch your tooling over to 4140, I was wondering what sort of heat treatment you do for forging your hammers. P.S. Love the podcast and have learned a ton. Thanks heaps. Benjamin Blacksmithing.
Yes, nice. Glad to hear it, dude. Glad to hear it.
Let's keep doing it.
Blue. Blue is student tools. I mean, it's as simple as that because, you know, part of running and managing CMA is managing multiple shops. And there's a distinct separation between my shop and the classroom and student tools and my tools. And that's not a separation that references the quality of the tooling. It just references the difference in where the tooling lives in the shop. So it's like red tools live on my side, blue tools live in the classroom, and then it's very easy to distinguish what tools are where. And a lot of times the stuff that I'm working on in my shop is very tooling specific, or you know, I'm mid-process on a job or a sculpture or a run of tools with the red tools, and that allows them to like stay there, and I know where they are and I know they're not going to change. And then the blue tools live in the classroom, and that allows the students to use the tools, learn with the tools, potentially damage the tools, you know, all that comes with running an educational shop. And and then blue tools get you know, organized, cataloged, and dressed appropriately to be safe and efficient for the students every class. And it's just a separation between shops, basically, is all that really means. And so sometimes red tools migrate into the classroom if a student needs one or something like that. But generally they have to ask, or I bring it in so I have a good idea as to what's what. And then when, you know, cleanup happens and organization and the shop gets put back to the way it should be at the end of a workshop, it's really easy to be like, okay, red tools over here, blue tools over here. And then it's just like, it's a nice reset, you know?
And then I get to forget my tools. So I went with Nick's colors, and now I've left my tools at CMA. I've left my favorite tongs twice, and I'm really embarrassed by that. But yeah, I go with Nick's colors just because I'm a glutton for punishment. I used to work in a metal shop. I worked in a fabrication shop, and everyone had their own tools, and nobody marked their tools. And it was a disaster because nobody knew whose was what. And it was like when they talk about, you know, wrenches, just even wrenches. It was like, it got to the point where I stopped bringing my own tools in because my stuff just got taken, and we didn't know whose was what. And it was like very frustrating. So having that ability to organize your tooling, especially if you're in a shop where there's multiple people, is monumentally, you know, helpful. So,
yeah.
And 4140.
Oh, yeah. What was that question? Like, how do I heat treat it?
The question is, I was wondering what sort of heat treatment you do for forging your hammers.
Cowboy heat treat, I guess.
Yeah, it's not true. You get, I don't believe that. You know what you're doing.
Yeah, maybe. You know, I heat them up to a certain temperature, and then I quench them in oil, and then I temper them. But I don't care too much about it. I'm a soft tool kind of guy, so you know, I think 4140 is tough, really, but it's not like really hard, you know. So I don't spend too much time trying to get it really hard. And if I need something to be really hard, then I'll probably select a different alloy.
That's an interesting difference between, you know, the type of tool making that you're doing and knife making, because there is an expectation with knives that they need to be a certain hardness and toughness, and they need to be able to be tough enough to hold an edge for a long time. But the way that, when we've talked about this in the past, is you're far more concerned, well, not far more concerned, but you're as concerned with safety as possible, leading you to switch over from 1045 to 4140.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even when it comes to like tong making or something, I think people get trapped in this thing where they feel like they need the strength of the alloy because of a weak geometry or forging. And I think if you focus on the geometry of your tool, the alloy becomes much less important.
I was talking to somebody at my shop, and he was asking me about, we were talking about construction. I recently got a piece of I-beam from with the World Trade Center, 9/11, and I was really, we were talking about it, and it was, it had a bend in it. And he said, and he asked me if I-beams were heat treated. And I said no, and I explained the construction of an I-beam, and you know, it's mild steel, and it's meant to have this kind of structure. The I-beam has a structure. It's meant to be used in the position of an I as opposed to the position of the H, because you have maximum strength in the construction of it as an I. And it was interesting because there was a lot of, you know, there is a lot of talk in regards to, you know, the material hardness versus the construction. And I was really, really interested in your thoughts in regards to construction versus, you know, versus the material itself.
Well, I think that's a really good example of strength in the geometry is an I-beam. An I-beam, actually, though, it's engineered to be stood up, and it's not very strong in the I position or the H position. And an I-beam is different than an H-beam. Those are two different structural cross sections, but both of them are made. The strength is in their standing up. You want to put where they function the best is vertically. So it's weight down on the profile of the I or the H. And if you have it in the I position, then it's only as strong as that flat bar web that's in between the two flanges. And if you put it in the H position, then you double that strength because you have double the vertical flat bar than you do in the I position. But all those beams are meant to be stood up with pressure down on them, and that's like how you build like a skyscraper or a bridge or something like that. They certainly do like have them horizontally and stuff on structural stuff, but I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know you know what you're talking about, and obviously it's something that I learned listening to you just now, and I appreciate it.
No, because they're horizontal and vertical in all kinds of different constructions. But I think it's just a selection by the engineer on how the strength needs to be. Like, you know, like when I look up at my ceiling here, I see a ton of horizontal I-beams. And then, you know, they come in all kinds of different thicknesses and widths and stuff like that. And I think there's, you know, engineers that understand how much weight each one can hold. And then you can multiply that when you put them together. And then there's like, how far apart are they and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, there we go into fabrication. And then the last question of the day, I fucked this up. I kind of put
no,
a
ton no,
of,
no, no.
I set a bad road.
That was funny, but whatever.
No, it's good. I mean, no, but it's all mild steel. It's not, you know, heat treated steel.
Totally. And it is like strength in the geometry, I think, is the point of all that. Right. And it's the way it's rolled that makes it strong.
Last question from my friend Matt Harris, who has been chirping at me all through the playoffs, MLB playoffs. He has been relentless with me in regards to the Baltimore Orioles and all season long, Orioles and Yankees. He's a wonderful guy, and I wish the Baltimore Orioles better success next year, at least better than the Yankees for his sake, because I don't know if I could take any more in the DMs. But Matt Harris says, do you have any plans to have an industrial-sized hydraulic press in the octagon?
I don't have any plans for that, no. And it's not because I don't want one necessarily. I just don't have any plans for it. But I am, you know, I am a hammer guy, so I don't really know that I would work very hard towards getting a hydraulic press in there. I think maybe if one fell in my lap someday, I might embrace it for certain processes or whatever. But you know, I've been exposed to and have had access to a variety of hydraulic presses throughout my career. And they've been really, really handy and useful for lots of different things. But I think, you know, in my heart, I'm a hammersmith. So most of the stuff that I design or place I want to be working at is in front of a hammer. So I think, you know, main focus right now really is to get all five hammers running in the octagon, and then, you know, see how that pans out as far as like layout, functionality, and stuff like that goes, and then kind of go from there. But like, I don't really love hydraulic presses that much. Does that make sense? I mean, I don't hate 100%. Them either, but like,
no, yeah, 100%.
It's not really, you know, I don't know that I'll be like forging material so big that the hammer can't forge it. And I think like that's where hydraulics really shine is, you know, they have that like pushing power, that really, really kind of like strong pushing power. And you can forge bigger stuff with hydraulics than you can with a hammer, because at a certain point, the engineering for the hammer just doesn't pay off for the size of the material. But I don't really think I'll get there, you know?
Unbelievable.
I don't know, man.
No,
it's
no,
kind of like,
no, I'm just,
I don't know anything about any of this stuff, any of the last two questions. So,
all right, everybody, that was the way it is. So listen to me, guys. If you like this show, we need your help. You need to provide us with questions, more questions, and it helps us. We do this about once a month. It's a really great, it's really helpful, it's really insightful. And if you're listening to this and you're just one of those people who are just like, I love this show. Well, if you love the show, show this show some help. Be collaborative and send us some more questions for Pat to answer. He's a wealth of knowledge. I learned stuff in this podcast just listening to him. Just today, the way he talked about the hammer faces, the way he talked about I-beams, the way he talked about other things. I learned nothing but great stuff from Pat, and you will too. So go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. Submit your questions for a great question with Pat Quinn. Go to the Center for Metal Arts. Follow them. Go submit your questions there. You can even go straight to DM, Handforge, and VT. That's Pat. And then you can submit your questions there. Wherever you are, submit your questions. We appreciate it. Pat, do you have any final thoughts or words or anything you'd like to say?
No, sir. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you because I really appreciate your time and your energy and the effort you put into this podcast. And I want to thank our listeners for providing great content and to be there for us. So, guys, we will be here next week, and as we always are, and we will be back with Pat next month for sure. So send in your questions, and Pat, thank you once again.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's always a pleasure. All right, guys, we will see you next week.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF, Donnelly Stewart Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue one last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.